Hello, I'm probably going to interrupt your listening a lot in this episode, and I apologize for that. But the reason why I'm interrupting so close to the start of the episode is because I just genuinely want to thank you for all of the support that I have received over the past 2 years. This day basically marks the day whereby I actually started the podcast, which is very, very cool. And I think that now it's time for you to actually see my face. Yes, I'm doing a voiceover. That's because it's late, and stuff like that. Logistics weren't working out. But genuinely, I do want to say thank you so much. And hopefully, we can actually grow a little fan base into like a bigger one. So if you're listening on YouTube, then you can like see a picture of myself and stuff like that. And if you're listening on Spotify or any other podcast listening platform, then I suggest that you pause on your podcast listening platform, go to YouTube, check out my face, and then go back and listen on Spotify. But I just wanted to say a massive, massive, massive thank you, and I appreciate you so much. Hi. Before we get started with this episode, I'd have to say that you're probably going to hear some cars and some hooting and some bicycles and some any single mode of transportation. Apologies for that. I cannot control the roads, unfortunately. Hopefully the sound will get better eventually, but for now, unfortunately, you're gonna have to deal with it. So hopefully it doesn't take you out of your listening experience, but enjoy. Welcome to Air Crash Investigation, the podcast, the show where we dissect and discuss prominent crashes in aviation history. I'm your host, as always, Kai Jordan, and in today's episode, we're going to be discussing Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409, the crew, the crash, the investigation. Before we continue, just make sure that you are comfortable, you have a snack, you have notes, whatever you do when you listen to this podcast, because this is about to be a long one, and I hope that you are ready to dissect this case with me. Let us get started.
The greatest aviation mystery of all time lies a massive passenger jet and the remains of its 239 passengers and crew.
Good morning. We have a smoke problem. And we're doing emergency descent to level 15140.
In December 1988, a passenger airliner was bombed over Scotland in what was one of the largest pre-9/11 terrorist attacks.
Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409 was a scheduled flight for the 25th of January 2010. Its origin was Beirut Rafic Hariri International Airport in Beirut, Lebanon, and its destination was Addis Ababa Bole International Airport, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The airplane used was the famous Boeing 737, and the call sign was Ethiopian 409. The captain of this flight was Habtamu Benti Nagasa, who was 44 years old. He joined the airline on the 27th of January 1989. He received his ratings as pilot in command for the Boeing 737-800 on the 16th of October 2009. Captain Nagasa's total flight hours were 10,233 hours, with 2,488 hours on the accident aircraft. His recent medical certificate was issued on the 25th of November 2009, and he was found medically fit to fly. Now, we do not usually go over how the pilot was in their personal life. However, this is incredibly important for this case in particular. So Captain Nagasa had a nice personality, was very polite, open to take criticism, healthy, did not smoke or drink alcohol, was keen on reading and sports, and had many sports equipment at his house. Records provided by Ethiopian Airlines do not show any reported sickness or any medical surgery. The only medication he was having was related to a hair fungus treatment. The first officer was Aluna Tame Rajpayan, who was 23 years old at the time of the crash. He joined Ethiopian Airlines on the 16th of January 2009. His ratings as first officer on the Boeing 737 were done and received on the 25th of June 2009. His medical certificate was issued on the 11th of June 2009, and it concluded that he had no limitations when flying. First Officer Bayan's total flight hours were 673, with 350 of those hours on the accident aircraft. The flight hours just show that he was a relatively young and new pilot, does not mean that he wasn't qualified properly. Now his personality. Interviews with the first officer's superiors, trainers, and friends revealed that he had a nice personality, was a good student who graduated among the best six in the flight academy. He had a good family life and relations, no particular medical conditions, save for an appendectomy at some point, an occasional/social smoker who loved his company and carefully prepared his flights. One of the pilots who trained the first officer and flew with him described him in the following terms. He seemed like a senior first officer on his call-outs and performance in flight. He says what he needs to say. He was not the quiet type. There were 5 flight attendants on board and they were properly qualified. There were 82 passengers on board. The aircraft that was used was the Boeing 737-800. This particular aircraft started working February of 2002. Its certificate of airworthiness was valid until the 11th of September 2010. And can we just stop here for a little bit of an intermission and just, I don't know, kind of reflect on how 2010 was. I was very young at that time, so I don't remember any of it that well. However, I can remember the joyousness that South Africa had during the World Cup of that year because it was hosted in South Africa. I just wanted to put that in there because that was a huge highlight for South Africa as a whole, because now South Africa is terrible to say the most. But let's go back to your episode. Up until this point, the aircraft had 26,459 flight hours and had underwent 17,823 cycles. So before we get started with the flight portion of this episode, I do have to give some context for this flight in particular. This information will be relevant for the investigation portion, so just make a few mental notes / physical notes if you are writing some of these things down. The 1983 Beirut bombing, or the 1983 Beirut barracks bombing, was an event that happened on the 23rd of October 1983. On this day, the Islamic Jihad organization quote-unquote sent truck bombs to buildings in Beirut and they exploded, aka the origin of this flight. There were 150 injuries and several deaths. Now, Lebanon also underwent the Lebanon War of 2006, or the 2006 Israel-Hezbollah War. Now, the reason why I am mentioning this and the reason why this one hurt more than the 1983 Beirut bombing is because the whole country was at war. So, this meant that more buildings would be destroyed, runways would be destroyed, and lives would be lost. However, after the war, the runways at this airport, to be specific, were fixed, but the fear of another war or a terrorist attack was still present and alive than ever. Finally, to add, the airport itself is surrounded by mountains, which, if we have heard from other disasters, they can pose a risk for airplanes, but this risk was accounted for during the building of these runways. The captain and first officer were getting ready to take off, and when I say get ready, I mean they were doing the appropriate checklist and adjusting their instruments. Captain Nagasa's instruments would show the weather, which was very important in that situation because the weather was pretty bad. There were thunderstorms in the flight path of the airplane, and we all know that thunderstorms are dangerous. First Officer Bayan's instruments would display the terrain surrounding the airport and the aircraft itself. The flight plan at that point was for the crew to head southwest, make a U-turn, and then head towards a navigational beacon checker. The air traffic controller gave the crew the thumbs up for them to take off. As the aircraft was accelerating down the runway, Captain Nagasa said, "You see that? What that was, we do not know, but we can just speculate and say that he saw like lightning. Genuinely, no one knows." Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409. Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409 takes off from Beirut Rafic Hariri International Airport at 2:30 a.m. The heading that the crew was given was 315 degrees. Once the airplane was airborne, the air traffic controller transferred Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409 to another controller. As I had mentioned, the weather wasn't great and there was a really bad thunderstorm in the flight path of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409. So to avoid the thunderstorm, Captain Nagasa started to bank the airplane a little bit to the right. The air traffic controller instructed Ethiopian 409 to climb to 29,000 feet or 8,839 meters. The weather started to worsen, which low-key created a little bit of panic, but not that much. The controller then instructed the crew to use the heading 270 degrees so that they could avoid the bad weather better. Due to the rain and thunderstorm, the crew could not hear the heading and they asked the controller to repeat. As they were asking the controller to repeat, the bank angle warning started to sound. This warning, if you do not know, lets the crew know that their turn is too steep and that the aircraft needs to level again. However, that's the problem. The crew had two options at this point. Option 1, level the plane out by turning it to the left, aka where the thunderstorm is, or option 2, ignore the bank angle warning and just keep turning right. So the crew was preoccupied with this and they were still thinking on what to do. The controller was still instructing the crew to use the heading 270 degrees. The crew did not hear this because as the controller was instructing, the stick shaker started to operate. If you do not know, the stick shaker basically tells the pilots that the aircraft is about to go into a stall. So to avoid a stall, Captain Nagasa decides to initiate a go around and he increases the speed of the aircraft. The tower is still repeating the fact that Ethiopian needs to use the heading 270 degrees. The crew is not listening to the controller at this point. The speed of the aircraft starts to reduce even though they were trying to increase it and they were heading towards the mountains. As they were heading towards the mountains, the airplane started to invert and dive. The crew and passengers were experiencing G-forces as you can expect. The controller was still trying to tell the pilots to use the correct heading when it went radio silent. Ethiopian Airlines Flight 409 crashed into the Mediterranean Sea only 5 minutes after taking off and nobody survived. Can I just take a little bit of a moment here before we get into the investigation to say that the flight portion of this episode sounds like it happened for hours on end when it actually happened within 5 minutes. Like, if you're reading this or if you're listening, because yeah, you are listening, you'd probably think that they were fighting with this aeroplane for at least 30 minutes to an hour, when in fact it took just 5 minutes to bring a whole plane down. It's hard to think about. It's definitely hard to think about. The investigation was conducted by the Ministry of Public Works and Transportation of Lebanon. The Lebanese investigators were assisted by the Bureau of Inquiry and Analysis for Civil Aviation Safety, or the BAA of France, and the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, of the United States. Then Boeing decided to just add their own research and skills because they were the manufacturer of the airplane. Operation Search and Rescue. So the Lebanese Army launched the search and rescue operation. The UNIFIL Naval Force, the US Naval Force, the French Naval Force and the British Naval Force joined the search due to the lack of equipment on the Lebanese Army side. In total, the search and rescue operation took 25 days. I'd like to think that it took this long because A, there were thunderstorms in the area, and B, the plane crashed into the ocean, and that is way harder to do the search and rescue operations. So when asking the aircraft controller, the investigators discovered that the controller tried to communicate with Ethiopian 409 several times and through the emergency frequency to no avail. The controller's supervisor said in a report that some orange light falling into the sea was seen. To add, some people said that we saw an orange explosion on the sea before the aircraft fell down. This is very concerning. The debris field was 300 meters or 984 feet long and 100 meters or 328 feet wide. It was 45 meters or 148 feet underwater too. Larger pieces of the fuselage, such as the tail section and aft fuselage, were found in the northern eastern portion of the wreckage field. The search operations identified two bulkheads associated with laboratories, aka the sink and the toilet, the galley floor mat, interior floor panels, a number of seat covers and cushions from the first and economy class, the crew's oxygen cylinder, one escape slide and two life rafts, two composite panels from the vertical stabilizer, one main landing gear wheel and tire, and a portion of the elevator and elevator tab. The investigators' general observations were that there was a lot of fragmentation on the fuselage. The components of the aircraft were not intact, obviously. The seats had loose padding and little to no covers, and there was no evidence of soot or smoke on the fuselage, which this is incredibly important because then it rules out the fact that the plane might have been brought down by a terrorist group or a war or something like that. The bodies were held and examined by the Beirut Rafik Hariri Governmental Hospital morgue. Most, if not all, of the bodies were affected by the high-speed impact with the water. The bodies had no evidence of burns, wounds, or cyanosis, aka the discoloration of the skin. Moreover, the death is the consequence of violent trauma with projection of the passengers against a hard surface, resulting in severe vital lesions that led to the immediate death before the drowning. It was also stated that passengers died as a result of multiple fractures and contusions with consequent acute hemorrhage and immediate death. This sounds so horrific. I know we're not supposed to have but at least they didn't feel it. But to be honest, they passed away immediately, like as soon as the aircraft hit the water. And at least they weren't kind of suffering with their injuries. I know we're not supposed to think like this, but at least there needs to be some kind of thing that we can hold on to instead of thinking about the fact that these people have suffered due to this crash. The surface wind at the airport at the time of takeoff was calm and there was no rain. There were scattered clouds at 26,000 feet or 7,925 meters. There were also reports of thunderstorms 10 kilometers or 6 miles away from the airport, which, if you think about it, is not really that far. Now, moving on from the meteorological information, the investigators also found out through the FDR that the crew did a lethal right turn to avoid the thunderstorms, but in doing so, they led to their own demise. The captain in particular was the one who initiated the turn, but why didn't First Officer Bayan say anything? If you do not know, just like how I also didn't know, Ethiopian Airlines had or has a policy that says that a captain who has less than 300 hours and first officer who has less than 100 hours on type shall not be rostered together. These requirements were met for this flight, but there wasn't really a massive gap between the pilot's flight hours and the airplane. In the past 90 days, which is what I am assuming, even though the final report didn't really state the time duration or the time period, Captain Agassa had 188 hours and First Officer Bayan had 350 hours. The program that the crew was trained under is considered to be a well-developed program, but the accident still happened. It was actually discovered that the accident happened due to a failure in basic piloting skills on the captain's side and a crew resource management or CRM failure on the side of the first officer. The first officer and the captain, if we're being frank, were unable to identify a possible subtle incapacitation, which we will discuss later on. Captain Nagasa's stall recovery training was classified as quote-unquote good, but he was unable to recover the airplane from the stall adequately. Moreover, during his final simulator check, Captain Nagasa had to repeat the simulator check, and someone had made a comment, concentration. Now, no one knows what this was about, nor they do not know what they were referring to, and the context behind it, but since Captain Agassa is in an aviation space, it probably has something to do with his concentration in some aspect of flying, which is incredibly concerning. The first officer was known to be assertive, but he wasn't in the cockpit. I mean, I am pretty sure that he saw that they were banking to the right, and he also did hear the bank angle sound, but he did nothing about it. Moreover, he sounded very calm and confident during the transmissions with the air traffic controller. Now, here is my chat. I think that even if in situations whereby like it's stressful to the max and you are really concerned that, you know, you're in a professional setting, so of course you're going to be like calm and confident so that you can get your point across and basically when you need help to get help. However, I think that First Officer Bayan was incredibly calm, and I think he kind of sort of didn't really explain the danger that they were in at that time because he was so calm and confident, which is kind of concerning. And why didn't he speak up or do anything to save the plane? But hey, he probably tried to do something, but it didn't work. We will never know. But let us go into subtle incapacitation. So before the flight took off, the crew started discussing how the food that they ate in Beirut was probably laced with weed. As a result, they could not sleep. Now, I know, and you probably know, when you're with a person that you are used to, or just when you are comfortable around a person, maybe with your friends, your family, or whatever, you're going to make some jokes that are kind of offside, or you're going to make like some comments that are kind of offside that are really, they sound really shady, okay? However, I don't think that you're going to make those type of comments, those type of jokes in a setting like cockpit before taking off. Especially since we all know that being high or you are drunk whilst doing an important job such as aviation or like flying an aeroplane, especially when you are probably going to risk another person's life, in this case 82 passengers' lives, 5 flight attendants' lives, it is very concerning and low-key inappropriate. If this is true, it is said that weed could cause gastronomical disorders and they could lead to incapacitation. So there's this really great article by skybrary.aero, which I'll link in the description box. It really does cover incapacitation a lot, but I'm just going to read the definition and some of the causes of incapacitation. So Pilot incapacitation is the term used to describe the inability of a pilot who is part of an operating crew to carry out their normal duties because of the onset during flight or the effects of physiological factors. Incapacitation may occur as a result of the effects of hypoxia or insufficient oxygen, smoke or fumes associated with a fire in the air or with contamination of the air conditioning system, gastrointestinal problems such as severe gastroenteritis, potentially attributable to food poisoning or food allergy, being asleep, a medical condition, a bird strike, or a malicious or hostile act such as an assault by an unruly passenger, terrorist action or small arms fire, or possibly malicious targeting of aircraft with high-powered lasers by persons on the ground. That is essentially describing how the crew might have suffered from subtle incapacitation, which is very, very scary. Especially since there wasn't like a flight engineer, for example, or a backup crew because the flight was so short. This is just turning out to be a mess. So with everything, there are power dynamics, you know, the relationship between a boss and an employee, for example. There's a power dynamic right there between a teacher and a student. There's a power dynamic right there between a child and their parent. There's a power dynamic right there. And this is a huge factor when it comes to the aviation space. So a captain is seen as the most experienced pilot, and as a result, most of the time they are listened to. In the air crash investigation / Mayday episode about this accident, this aspect was covered. So if you would like to hear a little bit more about that, I could try and put it on our Patreon as kind of like explaining their side when it comes to the aspect of power dynamics. So essentially, in summary, the episode kind of said that maybe the reason why First Officer Bayan didn't speak out is because Captain Agasa was quote-unquote overbearing, and he wanted to be in control of the aeroplane, kind of to be seen as like the hero and being seen as like the most experienced pilot and that type of stuff. Therefore, as much as First Officer Bayan saw the problem, he did not say anything out of fear. So the findings set out by the Ministry of Public Works and Transportation of Lebanon. Number one, the aircraft was certified, equipped, and maintained in accordance with the existing regulations and approved procedures. Number two, the aircraft was airworthy when dispatched for the flight. Number three, the aircraft's behavior was the result of its response to the pilot's input throughout the flight. Number four, there was no evidence of any defect or malfunction in the aircraft that could have contributed to the flight. Number five, this was the captain's first flight into Beirut. When they say this, they basically mean this flight didn't start in Lebanon. I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of like there was a flight before that the captain flew, basically from one place to Lebanon, and then he was on flight 409 with First Officer Bayan, and then they were flying to Ethiopia. Number six, the crew expressed some concerns as a result of the meal they had during the layover in Beirut, and that could have affected the quality of their sleep prior to operate the flight. Number seven, the captain's actions, statements, and degraded performance during that period were consistent with the effects of spatial disorientation and loss of situational awareness that could have been the result of a subtle incapacitation, although there was insufficient evidence to determine the reasons of that incapacitation. And number eight, the first officer's failure to abide by all the airline's SOPs and intervene with the captain throughout most of the events of the flight, even when called to do so, contributed to the flight crew's degraded performance. Now, there are more, like there are a lot of findings So you can read that in the final report on our Patreon. So there were many causes and contributing factors that were listed in the final report, and I'm just going to read five of them. Number one, the flight crew's mismanagement of the aircraft speed, altitude, headings, and attitude through inconsistent flight control inputs, resulting in a loss of control. Number two, the flight crew's failure to abide by CRM principles of mutual support and calling deviations hindered at any timely intervention and correction. Number three, the manipulation of the flight controls by the flight crew in an ineffective manner resulted in the aircraft's undesired behavior and increased the level of stress of the pilots. Number four, the prevailing weather conditions at night most probably resulted in spatial disorientation to the crew and led to the loss of situational awareness. Now, I want to stop right there and just kind of explain this point in case you are a little bit lost. So basically, a lot of investigators have noticed that at night, spatial disorientation occurs, and spatial disorientation is defined as the inability of a pilot to correctly interpret aircraft altitude or airspeed in relation to the earth or other points of reference. So because at night there's no horizon, for example, many pilots deal with spatial disorientation despite the fact that there are instruments that kind of act as an artificial horizon. So that's basically the fourth point. Then number five, the relative inexperience of the flight crew on type combined with their unfamiliarity with the airport contributed most likely to increase the flight crew workload and stress. Now that we are done with that, some kind of good news in terms of the recommendations set out by the Ministry of Public Works. Number one, the operator should revise its CRM program in order to stress on the first officer's assertiveness and leadership requirements, especially in periods of abnormal performance. Number two, the operator should consider its classification of airports where non-technical constraints might affect flight operations and brief their flight crew accordingly. Number three, the operator should re-examine his crew pairing and scheduling policies in order to ensure a less stressful cockpit environment. Number four, the operator should consider establishing write-up criteria for pilots' training files in order to avoid adverse effects of any misinterpretation by the trainees. And number five, the operator should consider developing his safety oversight program in order to detect such potential flight crew performance. So essentially, one of the main points of the recommendations are that airlines should train their first officers to be more assertive and to actually try and fix problems, for example, that are done by the captain, and shouldn't just like sit back and just be subdued, calm, confident, whatever you name it. But thank you so much for listening. This was a very long one. I hope that you enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. The links will be in the description, Patreon, all that good stuff. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you next week.